Okay, so we are at the 25th of June 2018. Do we know the Hebrew date? Follow the instructions here. It is the 12th of Tammuz, Tavshanayin Ches. And we turn towards the very end of Parshas Emor. So the last parak, as we've gone through before, includes really two mitzvos and then a story, and then several mitzvos in that story's aftermath. So it had the story, the mitzvah of the menorah, the mitzvah of the setting up of the lechem ha'panim, the setting up of the showbreads on the shulchan, and then the story of the mechalel, the one who cursed God, so to speak, then conclude by a couple of mitzvos that are at the end of that. And we'll try to maybe tie some of it together. It didn't seem much on the menorah, but on the lechem ha'panim there is a couple of different interesting things to point out. Number one is the idea of the lechem ha'panim. What is the story of the lechem ha'panim? That it is... when was it taken? When was it taken off? Right, so it was put down on Shabbos. It was taken off the following Shabbos. It was held over throughout the duration of the week. Then there is a little bit of a question of when it was eaten. Was it only eaten on the Shabbos itself, or could it have been eaten Shabbos and Motzi Shabbos? We probably assume Shabbos and Motzi Shabbos, which perhaps is part of the idea of the Malava Malka, that we extend the Shabbos into Motzi Shabbos, into what takes place next. So we actually mention. They point out here, from Simon here points out from the Levush that we in the beginning of our davening on Musaf on Shabbos, so we actually make reference to the Lechem HaPanim. It's a little bit hidden, but here it is. Tikanta Shabbos, in the very beginning of Musaf, Tikanta Shabbos v'titzer korbanoseha. We've established Shabbos, we found favor in its offering. Tzivisa perusheha im sidurei nisacheha. We have instructed regarding its commentaries, along with the order, and it's translated here as the showbreads. What's the word? The order of its nisacheha. What's nisacheha? So he translates here as showbreads, but here's a little note. I didn't look this up before. Where is the... no, it's up here. Although the literal translation would be the pouring offerings, the nisachim are things that are poured, so it probably more has to do with the lechem ha'panim, because the lechem ha'panim specifically have a connection to Shabbos. So he points out here that there were translations that translated it as and the nisachim, right, and the libations that take place. That's a bit of a problem. So he quotes from Ephraim Zalman Margolius, who wrote many, many, many different things. Clearly a brilliant, brilliant person, lived in the 1800s, early 1900s, that he said that he found the translation of the Siddur that translated, and he had a problem. The question there was raised, this was a period when the Reform was growing, etc. Could we have prayer in English? Is it appropriate to pray in English? That was the Shaila that was kind of burning at the time. And like anything Reform, so it was fought back from the Orthodox perspective very, very strongly. Meaning, even if we might technically nowadays say, oh, it's the big deal, it doesn't sound like a big problem, any change that was seen in the services then was fought back vehemently, and there were found sources for it. So, for instance, things that we find in the shul, for instance, where the shulchan is, things like that. So that became like a massive, massive issue with many, many sources that are found. Chassam Sofer's statement of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, anything that is new is considered to be prohibited. So that's what this is talking about. So can we have an English prayer, or not English, or German, or translated, a vernacular prayer book? So he said, besides the fact that it's wrong, says Rav Chaim Zalman Margolius, another problem is that the translation is often wrong. And one of the exhibit A that he brought was this paragraph where he said the order of the nesachim, and it was translated as the libations of wine. But why would that be specifically pointed out here? I mean, if we're talking about the specialness of Shabbos, so the nesachim wasn't anything unique that appeared on Shabbos that didn't appear any other day of the week. What was unique about Shabbos? The lechem ha'panim. So in Siddurei Nisachaha, he suggests, and apparently the article Siddur translated it accordingly, as referring to the lechem ha'panim rather than to just simple yayin nisachim, which is done on a daily basis. So that's one issue with regards to the lechem ha'panim. So it's caught in, you can remember every Shabbos as we daven Musaf, that's what it's a reference to, the lechem ha'panim, which had special significance with regards to Shabbos. Now how many, is there any other recognition on Shabbos of the lechem ha'panim? that we can think of. So, what if I were to, if I wanted to have over the course of Shabbos some reference to the Lechem Hapanim and mitzvahs that we do, what would be a good place to put it?
Two challahs.
Two challahs. Okay. So, how's two challahs a reference to the Lechem Hapanim?
Two rows.
So let's there's two rows, right? 12, two rows each. So that would be good. So I didn't notice anybody that said that. But there's two other references. One is one could find by the Hasidim. A friend of mine had a relationship, still has a relationship with the Bianer Rebbe. It was the Bianer Rebbe in Eretz Yisrael. So if you know like Geula, so I don't know I haven't been on the buses in Israel in I guess over a decade at this point. But all the way down when you go all the way down Geula, when you get to the that corner of Me'e Sha'arim Geula, that central area, and you make a left. So the place all the way down at the end of that block is the Bianer temple, like the Bianer castle that appears there. So the Bianer Rebbe, Rav Menachem Friedman, is actually, he's American. It's actually an interesting story. His father was a psychology professor at Yeshiva University. Is very much in that world. And if one wants to see how he ended up going from being an American kid to Israeli Hasidic Rebbe, one can take a look in the book Who Will Lead Us, which was published in the last couple of years, where it describes the entire story. But he had relationships with, so a friend of mine had a relationship with him, because his father used to go to the bungalow in Chapman Lake, and so he went in for Shabbos. And he comes back, he said, I don't know, it was weird. He picked up the cover, the challah cover, on Friday night, and there's 12 challahs sitting there. So what's the story? So there is an idea, Al Pi Kabbalah, of having 12 challahs for each of the meals of Shabbos. Zecher L'Lechem Hapanim.
It's an enormous pitch, right?
Right. So it becomes a little more complicated.
Rabbi Gross's...
Right. The Rabbi Gross tish, we're going to have trouble. We're going to end up with a lot of carbs if we distribute 12 challahs to everybody. But he said it was two big challahs surrounded by little challah rolls, etc. I don't know if this was at the tish, or I think this was at his private meal. Then you have lunch with the rest of the week.
Was there a bowl of frankincense between the two?
No, so that there was. You didn't say there was. That I don't know about. But there was. It could be. The truth is, I was wondering, those salt holders you've seen like in Hungarian homes where everything is silver. So they have those salt cup things with little spoons. So I was wondering if maybe that was safer as well. That way you could use the same salt on Pesach also if you have one of the... you have one of those for Pesach?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So maybe that little spoon is a zecher to the Lechem Hapanim. I don't know. You can look on that. But besides that, the Vilna Gaon said, remember that, it's another one of these big conflicts about the Hasidim. So this is one of the changes. We're going to have 12 challahs instead. So the Vilna Gaon, of course, flips everything around and says, no, we'll get you 12 challahs in the old style. How you get 12 challahs in the old style? So if you take each challah that you have over the course of Shabbos and cut them all, how many do you get? Well, come on. The obvious answer is 12, right?
Yeah.
How are you going to get to 12?
Well, we cut them in half.
Right, if you cut each challah that you have on Shabbos into two, so you'll get to 12 challahs over the course of Pesach, right? And that idea that a cut would even count as a challah, he points out that there is a Gemara in Masechah Shabbos where it says the Rabbi Zeira used to pull a big enough, the Gemara says, Rabbi Zeira have a batza akula shiruseha, that he used to take a big enough piece that would last him the entire meal. And the Gemara actually asks, isn't that gluttonous to just take a massive piece of challah that you're going to then have? I think then they used to have challah, they used to have bread for the entire course of the meal. So isn't that gluttonous to take such a big piece of challah? He says, no. The fact that he doesn't do it the rest of the week indicates that this is something that he's doing special for Shabbos, and therefore it's not going to qualify as being gluttonous. But wait a second, what are we talking about taking a big piece? The answer is that he cut the big piece in the beginning of the meal, and that was therefore his unique challah that he had over the course of Shabbos. Even though it was only half a piece, it was then considered a full piece, and therefore there are those that have the minhag of those that want to follow the minhag agra when they cut challahs on Pesach, on Shabbos, actually cut both at the same time. They'll line one on top of the other, which is the minhag, and cut both together to indicate that you have four then, and then four Friday night, four on Shabbos lunch, and then four on Shal Shudas as well. And that gives you the 12 challahs over the course of Shabbos, which is, of course, a zecher to the Lechem Hapanim. The other idea of Lechem Apanim is a famous Gemara Maseches Chagiga. Towards the end of Gemara Maseches Chagiga, which discusses the mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel, so the Mishnah tells us that after Yontif was over, after the Shalosh Regalim were over, they used to have to take all the kelim of the Beis Hamikdash to the mikvah, because they had everything out on display, and they had Kohanim that were coming that weren't necessarily such knowledgeable as being Kohanim, and they were, some weren't exactly keeping the highest levels of Tumah V'Tahara. So just to make sure, they took all of the kelim and put them away, you know, and brought them to the mikvah. So where it says an exception to that was the Shulchan. They couldn't do it to the Shulchan, so therefore there were they put around the Shulchan these, you know, the poles with the velvet ropes, you know, saying "Do not touch the shulchan." I mean, well, you can touch these other things. We'll be able to handle that if the hamunah makes those tamei. But the shulchan we're not able to. Why not? So the shulchan has the din of tamid, that the lechem apanim have to be on the tamid. It's actually a halacha which would have qualified for something else to talk about today. The idea that the lechem are there regularly, and that's a siman having to do with Talmud Torah. The Talmud Torah has to be something that's done continuously, etc. But the lechem, so therefore, because you couldn't take the time off to bring the lechem up, to bring the shulchan to the mikvah, so they couldn't have anybody touch the lechem apanim. But nevertheless, the Gemara famously says that they would pick up the lechem apanim and show it to everybody, and show the great miracle that the same way that it was put down on in the Kodesh on one Shabbos, it stayed the same way 1 week later. That nothing changed from the moment that it was put down to the moment that it was taken up on the Shabbos, on the subsequent Shabbos when it was actually removed. So, just a side note: what was it? I mean, what was that unique feature that they were demonstrating? So Rashi jumps in and says that it was just as hot when it was put down as it was when it was picked up a week later. So Tosso says, "Well, wait a second. When was the lechem apanim baked?" Right, was lechem apanim baked on Shabbos? So the answer is no. Lechem apanim was not baked on Shabbos. When was it baked? It was baked on Friday. It was baked on Erev Shabbos. So why was it still hot on Shabbos? So he suggests that maybe it wasn't, that wasn't the miracle. It was just that it didn't become stale. It didn't become moldy. I mean, it was sitting up and they were piled one on top of another pretty closely. And it's on this big metal table. And there's no air conditioning, and it's 95, 100 degrees outside. There's massive fires going on right nearby, so maybe that would cause them to go bad. So no, it doesn't go bad. It's still moist. It's still good, etc. Later on. So that's a bit of a question. What exactly was the miracle? But there was some kind of miracle that took place from 1 week to the next, and that was shown to all of Klal Yisrael that recognize that look at the miracle that Hashem does with regards to the Lechem Apanim. So he quotes here from the Pre-Tzaddik, from Tzaddik Milublin, that why is that the miracle that was chosen? There are several miracles that took place in the Beis Hamikdash every day. Why is that the one that they wanted to make sure that everybody saw? That everybody saw the miracle specifically with regards to the Lechem Apanim. So his suggestion is, and we'll show a couple of other suggestions as well, but his suggestion is, from Rav Tzadok, that the Yud Beis Lechem Apanim represent what? They represent the Yud Beis Shvatim. And at the time when all of the Shvatim come, so they want to record, that's a time that could lend itself to perhaps a break of Achdus. You know, people might not know such other people and might get annoyed by other people, etc., and they might start mocking other people. Other people might be doing things differently. So the Yud Beis Shvatim, the idea that there's Yud Beis Lechem Apanim, represent that all are equal in front of Hashem. And the idea of Yud Beis Shvatim also, and this idea is out there as well, represent different ways of Avodas Hashem. That they perhaps had different styles, they might have different Minhagim from one from another, they might have different even Piskei Halach, although there was a Sanhedrin Gedolah at that time, but they had different styles of doing the Avodas Hashem. So perhaps the emphasis on the Lechem Apanim is to demonstrate to Klal Yisrael that they're all good, that all of you have something that's specific that you are contributing. Right, I would add as well that perhaps was a time, right, that was interaction between the tribes that they didn't, you know, people might feel either I'm better than you, or they might feel worse than you for some reason when the different tribes came in and they had to work together, and not just they had to work together, there was only one Beis Hamikdash, right? So they're all coming in, we might have different styles, we might have different ways of pronunciation, we might have different forms of tefillah, and now all of a sudden we're being forced together, and that will lead to friction. So in order to demonstrate demonstrate that no, all good, where everybody has the everybody has an appropriate representation in front of Hashem. So the lechem apanim, perhaps that was the symbolic nature of specifically showing off the miracle of the lechem apanim. So he continues on and says that that perhaps might explain the connection to the story of the Megadif that is following. It's a little bit odd. Vayikra in general, there are only a couple of psukim of story, of narrative that is found throughout the book of Vayikra. One of them is found here, that also in the middle of these mitzvahs, menorah, lechem apanim, and some other mitzvahs that are given in the beginning of next week's parsha, of the story of the Megadif. What happened there? So the way we understand it is that the Megadif was a... the Chumash itself says that he was a son of a woman Yisrael, and his mother was a Yisrael, and his father was a Mitzri, and therefore he wasn't entitled to a chelek of the Shvatim. So that was part of his taina. His taina was, I thought we're all supposed to be holy, we're all supposed to have sanctity. Why am I considered a lesser than the rest of you? And his answer is, the way he writes it here is because you are. Because you are. Your father wasn't Jewish. And therefore you don't have a chelek in the Shevet. And that is a problem. And you know, that itself is an issue. Actually, maybe we might be speaking about that this coming Shabbos with regards to issues of Emunah, when a child perhaps is suffering for the sins of his parents because his parents had some sort of a child is a mamzer or things like that. So yeah, you're suffering. There was something that was done wrong. But within the regular realm of the Yud Beis Shvatim, so all those that have fathers that are members of Yud Beis Shvatim, so they will all have a chelek. It's interesting, I was listening yesterday, this past weekend, the Headlines podcast talked about the issue of Geirus, and specifically the issue of Geirus, or lack of Geirus, in the Syrian community. Have you know this? That in the Syrian community has they call it the Takana, that was signed in like the 20s, and even before that there was something about 15 years earlier, that they will not permit any ger into the Syrian community. They won't allow any of their children to marry a ger. If a person moves in, even if a ger from Syria shows up, he will not be considered a member of the community. He won't be able to be buried in the community. His children, even the children of this ger, even if he goes and marries a nice Ashkenazi woman, if they have a child, or a gioris marries a nice Ashkenazi man and they have a child, so that child will not be permitted to marry into the Syrian community. And if they do, the married Syrian is sort of excommunicated. That married Syrian will not be allowed to have aliyahs, won't be buried in the cemetery, and will be on the outs. And so much so that that one of the people that he interviewed, a Rabbi Dweck, who was a rabbi in Tudil, and then I think moved to Yerushalayim, so he, that apparently Rabbi Avadi Yosef, who is not Syrian, right? We sometimes from Ashkenazim, we like just mix all Sephardim together. So that's not appropriate. They're really very different from one another. Syrians, Iraqis, Egyptians, North Africans, Spanish, Portuguese, right? They really are very different from one another. So Avadi Yosef, who was Egyptian, I think originally following the Iraqi tradition, showed up in, I believe he is Iraqi, and he ended up being in Egypt for a while. That's how the Abrahams are followers of Avadi Yosef, because they are from China, India, Iraq. So he came and pled the case of a specific ger, or a specific yoris, I forget, and is a Rav Avadia Yosef. While he was chief rabbi in the 70s, he showed up as chief rabbi to the Syrian head of the Syrian community and said, this ger should be allowed to be able to marry in. And they said, sorry, take a hike. No, it's not happening. So the person telling said that Rav Avadia Yosef commented to him. He's like, after they told me that, I wasn't able to sleep that entire night. To which the interviewer, David Lichtenstein, commented, "Yeah, Rav Avadia Yosef's not used to being told no too often." But that's the reality. And why do they do this? Why do they have this as a takana against intermarriage? They say if we allow gayrim in, so that kind of breaches the wall a little bit, and we're not, and that's going to be our way of preventing intermarriage. And they say that in the Syrian community, their intermarriage rate is less than 1%. Right, so they're able to. It's a different communities have different perspectives. Now, if every community would decide this, so that's a problem. Right? I mean, Gerim should be allowed in somehow, but that's communities have the right to make their own types of decisions. Okay.
Is the biggest Syrian community in Deal?
I believe, or Brooklyn, or both. Or they own houses in both. Not familiar enough.
In Brooklyn, we're about 70.
Flatbush. I mean, the yeshiva Flatbush is known for having many, many Syrians in it. Yeah. Okay. So a couple of other comments with regards to this issue of Yilechem HaPanim.
Are they ever eaten?
Yeah, they eat on Shabbos.
But it's there for a full week.
That's the miracle. That's the miracle, that they would hold it off all to see that, look, this miracle stayed the same, and it would be eaten the following Shabbos by the Kohanim. It would be split by the incoming Kohanim and the outgoing Kohanim, and there's a bit of a question as to maybe the, I forget which one, one of them might get more than the other one because they're in charge for that day, but the Kohen Gadol got his portion, right? That was actually a halacha day a week and a half ago. The Kohen Gadol got his portion, and the rest were divided up amongst the Kohanim that were working there.
In the Kahati translation, and instead of saying show bread, they say SHEW bread. Is there a reason why they make that translation?
Nope, I don't know. Yeah, he has another idea here. He quotes the Sefer here, Yalkut Lekachtov, so he quotes from Rav Mem Ilan, not sure who that is, but he explains as well, what is the significance of this Nes? So when did this take place? So this took place, right, on the Shalosh Regalim. So what was the Shalosh Regalim back in the day? That was the time when everybody would go to Yerushalayim, and they would see all the amazing things, and then they would go home until the next of the Shalosh Regalim when they would come back. But they were getting their inspiration at that point for the time that they were heading back. So they were demonstrating the Lechem HaPanim, that the Lechem HaPanim is a similar concept, that it's put out on Shabbos. The Avodah of the Lechem HaPanim takes place on Shabbos, and the Kedusha of it is supposed to be shared throughout the week. So that perhaps is the message that they are trying to instill, that yes, that we understand that you're going back to work and you're going back to your communities and you're going to have things to do there, etc. And you're not going to be able to maintain the level that you're at now while you're standing in the Beis HaMikdash. But realize that, you know, it's a continuation, that it's all supposed to go from stretch to, you know, from period to period, and the high that you get now should hopefully last you until you're able to come back. He says as well now, we also, the Beis HaMikdash might have fallen, we're not able to go into the Beis HaMikdash, but yet we also have Shabbos and Yantif, where we are able to devote ourselves to Avodas Hashem, and then we go back to work over the course of the week, or we come to learn it for Seder for the duration of the week. But that inspiration that we get in those periods of time should hopefully last us throughout the week. And then he has another story here that was placed in front of Hashem, and he tells the story of Rav Yitzchak Blazer, otherwise known as Rav Itzel Petelberger, because he came from Petersburg. I think he was the rabbi actually in St. Petersburg, and then traveled around. So he tells the story here that that apparently he, when he became the Rosh of what they called the Beis HaTalmud in Kelm, he himself, even though the minhag apparently was for some reason not to do Tashlich on Rosh Hashanah, he went ahead and did Tashlich on Rosh Hashanah. Why do you go ahead and do Tashlich on Rosh Hashanah? But as he said, like, we don't have to outsmart the Ramah. The Ramah says that we do Tashlich on Rosh Hashanah. And, you know, when I go to the next world and they say I'm not so smart, I'll say, listen, I don't have to be so smart. I just follow what it says in Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah says what it says, it, then that's what I'm going to do. But besides that, I'll tell you a story. And the story goes that there was once a rabbi who got up on Shabbos and gave a special drasha on Shabbos about how there was breads that were baked on Friday and were placed in front of Hashem for Shabbos. So the simple villager who heard this drasha goes home to his wife and says, you know, we haven't been doing this, but we should do this. We should bake the challahs every Friday. We should bake 12 challahs every Friday and bring them to Hashem. So that's what his wife did. So his wife, that Shabbos, baked 12 challahs, and he goes to shul, opens the aron. The shul's empty. It's Friday afternoon. No one's in the shul on Friday afternoon. And he goes and places the challahs in the aron. He leaves. Out comes the shamish a little bit later. He's got to make sure that there's enough wine, that, you know, they used to keep the wine in the kiddush cup in the aron also. So goes the shamish. He goes to the aron. He makes sure the wine is there set up before Shabbos. Oh, look at that! Someone must be nice to me and wants me to have enough to eat for the week. So he takes the 12 pieces of bread and he goes home with it. And of course, this happens week after week after week that. This fellow in town bakes 12 challahs, puts it in the aron, and the shamish comes and takes it out and eats that for the duration of the week. So one week he goes and puts his 12 challahs in, and the rabbi walks in. All right, so what are you doing? He says, oh, I'm putting my 12 challahs in. Why? He says, that's the mitzvah of the Lachem HaPadim that you darshaned about 4 months ago. To which the rabbi said, really? People listen to my drushas? No. I said, no, I wasn't talking about things that you should do. I was talking about things that, you know, that was done during the time of the Beis HaMikdash. We don't do this Bizman HaZeh. So he said, yeah, but I've been putting in every week, and somehow when I come back on Shabbos morning, they're gone. So someone's been taking them. So the rabbi said, oh, something must be going on. This isn't something that you should be doing. So the rabbi goes and investigates. He realized the shamash had been doing this and, you know, told the shamash to stop and we're not doing this anymore. That night the rabbi had a dream. And he came, someone came to him in a dream. Nemar l'rav v'chalom, shekivin shefriya l'zuk hazeh b'avodasim hatmimah, that because he was now taking away from this simple couple their pure avoda, their pure service to Hashem, nigzar alav shelo yotzi eshnaso. There's a gezeira place on the rabbi's head that he's not going to live out the year. Shekim yizman shechar beis hamikdash lo yad nachas ruach kazeh lifnei hamakom. That from the time of the destruction beis hamikdash, there was no such nachas to Hashem like he was getting from this young couple. So it says Rav Itzel of Petelberger, he says, you know, what's Tashlich? Why are we not doing Tashlich? We have more advanced things to do. Tashlich is, for me also, I always had trouble with the whole Tashlich thing, especially if you've ever gone to Eretz Yisrael Rosh Hashanah. It's a little hard to, you know, Tashlich in Eretz Yisrael is done by, you find a sewer someplace, or they told me in Karabiyab, they said, you know, they've gone up to the top of the base matters and said, you know, like 50 years ago, before the city of Ashdod was built, you used to be able to see the Mediterranean from here. So we'll do Tashlich from here. It's not such a big deal in the yeshivas, but on the other hand, the idea that, you know, for us, the idea of a simple person to go to the lake, to the river or the lake, and to say, oh, I'm casting out my sins to Hashem, and that's their avoda. So that A is meaningful, and said Rav Itzel of Petelberger, so that's why I do it. I do it because maybe Hashem will accept my simple tefillos, not my advanced tefillos, and not my advanced learning, etc. But the avoda of a simple Jew is perhaps very important in front of Hashem as well. It's in the Sefer called Tenuas Hamasur. The source of Rav Itzel of Blazer saying it over is in Tenuas HaMusar, which is a several volume work about the Rabbanim of the Musar movement.
But I've heard that story.
Yes, I've heard of different versions of it.
I wonder it doesn't go back to May.
No. My roots, I heard about it recently because Michael Lieber told it over at Shabbos in the Park a couple of weeks ago. That's a win-win thing. So Michael Lieber told this story in a little bit of a different way about a child who wanted to bring things to Hashem and realized it was going, and then they realized a poor person was getting it, to which the son said, oh, I thought Hashem was taking it. Now all I see is, you know, Yossel the beggar is taking it. Which the father said, there's nothing better than it being given to Yossel the beggar. Right? That was his version of the story. So, all stories have happened. Some just may not have happened yet.
Well, Rabbi Wein says they're all true.
They're all true. Just
but they haven't
happened yet, right? That's Rabbi Wein's, right? The code Rabbi Wein. Right. All my stories are true, just some haven't happened yet. All right. Oh, I see your time is up, so I guess I'll stop here. Pick up. So, Shem, Marcus Bahar, soon enough.